Okay, I'm here today at the Racing Post Offices with Paul Keeley. Paul, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us.
No problem.
Now, as a tipster, do you feel much pressure and responsibility knowing that your followers are going to invest their hard earned in your selections?
Yes and no. I mean, obviously, there's a certain amount of professional pride that comes with tipping. I think it's more important sometimes for me to tip a winner than it is for back a winner, although I will say that I back virtually everything I tip. I mean, I am a punter first and foremost. I would say, you know, and I've always said to people who've asked on Twitter, and I say, who else should we follow? And my answer is actually nobody. You know, I like to come out and present a case and provide an argument. And if that, you know, if you agree with that argument, then go ahead and punt it. But if you think I'm talking nonsense, then don't be afraid to go your own way. Because look, at the end of the day, as a tipster, especially when you tip the sort of prices I tip at, I'm going to be wrong 80% of the time at least. So, you know, make your own mind up. But I like to think I present a case with a good argument.
So how many hours in a day would you typically devote to studying form?
When I'm working on the tip, then, I mean, as many as possible. I mean, I'm one of those people that I can do it casually as well as, you know, go really delving in. I sit in front of the telly with my iPad, for example, in the evenings when I'm not working, and I'm still looking while I'm watching the TV, and, you know, I'm watching videos. It's a comfortable way to do it. But then in the morning, I'm up at my laptop. I like to give it as much as I can, basically. I watch loads and loads of videos. It's the one advantage you've got when you work in the industry, that you can spend loads of time, because I think when it comes to punters who've got, you know, what I call real jobs, they obviously don't have that time, but I do, so I spend as much as I can and I enjoy it anyway.
So I was going to say, is it a passion then? You'd be doing it anyway?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, I joined the Racing Post in 1987 and it took me until 2010 before I actually transferred across to the racing side. But I've always followed racing more than, you know, I covered all sorts of sports for the Post to start with, but I've always been a racing man.
Okay, you're one of these lucky people that've got all this stuff in your head and you can just put a lot of it out?
There's some in there. I would say, obviously, when it comes to the top racing, which I like to think is that's what I specialise in, then there's a lot of it in there already. You do need reminding, obviously. There's so many horses, especially when it comes to the flat season. You've got all the two-year-olds coming through, so you can't store everything. But I think I've got a fair amount of knowledge in there.
Okay, so how seriously do you take your own punting, and are you sort of successful over 12 months at it?
I punt largely for fun. I wouldn't say I'm a huge punter. I'm probably a smaller punter now than I was when I was a bad punter years ago, funny enough. I thought when I joined the Racing Post I would be winning a fortune because I'd meet so many people in the know, and it doesn't actually work like that. You know, I suppose most people, if they follow tips from supposed inside information, that, you know, they find out they'll soon go skint, because most of it is nonsense. I'm reasonably successful. You know, I've been stopped by a few, I get cut by others. I suppose, you know, I'll be perfectly honest and it'll annoy some people, but I suppose the profile at the Racing Post allows me to have accounts when I might not have them. I don't take the mickey. I don't go in and ask for hundreds, you know, 500s and thousands on. I bet at big prices anyway, generally, and they will get cut. So I do okay.
Okay, we won't ask you exactly what sort of stakes you have, but do you put much value on staking plans with your own personal punting?
Personal punting, I've never, ever shied away from the fact that I am terribly indisciplined. I always have been, and, you know, we're 35 years into a punting career now. I don't suppose it's going to change very much. I mean, sometimes when I feel like I need to win with my own punting, I'll rein it in a little bit. But I have a lot of what you call action bets. Just for the sake of it, can't help myself. I like it. I take all the big stuff seriously, but if the telly's on, I'll end up having a couple of quid on, you know, whatever it is.
So you've never actually considered being a full-time punter?
Well, I it's funny enough, you get this, and one of the things on Twitter, you get these people say, if he was any good, he'd go pro. And what they don't realise, first of all, is that professional punters work harder than everybody. You know what I mean? There's some sort of idea that they're just sitting on a yacht somewhere making money, and it's absolute nonsense. I've met a couple, like, you know, and they're afraid to go on holiday in case they miss something. You know what I mean? And, you know, they really, really work hard. We all know Neil Channing. Neil Channing probably expends more calories trying to run around shops getting on than I do, you know, in a week. Like, you know what I mean? It's just a case of there's that much work to be done, and I can get paid to do it as well. You know, so, you know, I've been lucky enough to work for the Racing Post for 31 years, and it's not a job. You know, so, you know, I'm happy as I am.
So when you sit, get down to the nitty-gritty of form now, because I'm interested myself in this, what would be the hardest part of unravelling a race? You sit down, you lay the paper out, whatever it is you do, there's the race. Where do you start? What's the hardest part of it?
I don't know if you say there is any hard part. There's just a way to start and a way to work your way through. And what I've always tried to do is try and find the favourite first. There's various ways you can do it. You can watch videos, you can look at ratings, you see form figures. I mean, it can be very obvious. You've got a horse with 3 runs next to its name, trained by John Gosden. You can be pretty damn sure it's going to be fab. But you work around what you think the best horse is on form and the one that all punters are going to go for, because, that's what happens. And then I try to find out, to think to myself, can I get this beat? And then I delve into as I look at, I look at the racing post ratings on the race card. I always change the order of the card to the top racing post rating, because it gives me an idea of what our handicappers reckon. This is before they've tweaked them for their own tips as well, because you've got to remember that it's a tipping service and a rating service. They will look at their ratings and decide to themselves, well, I don't think this one can do it on the ground, etc. Conditions aren't right. So I like to look at the pure ratings before they do it. So first, as soon as the decks come out, those ratings are on there. And then just work away, chip, ground, trip, trainer, everything really. I mean, just keep looking. I spend ages.
Is there something that you like to find about a horse in a race that you think other people don't spot, that it's, there's something. Is there anything there?
Yeah, well, this is one when it comes to racing post ratings. One thing I like doing, right, is watching a horse's racing post rating go up while its handicap comes down, because they look like they're out of form. They might be running fifth, sixth, seventh, that sort of thing, but they're actually slowly improving their RPR, and it's getting closer to where the handicap mark is, and you know that a horse is becoming well enough handicapped and running well enough to maybe do it, and sometimes they can be massive prices. There was one... it wasn't a case of a handicap going down, but there was a horse called Eugenio that won at Newmarket a few weeks ago. He was he had actually run the best racing post rating of any of the horses last time out, and it was the outside of a lot when the market came up. It just didn't make sense, and so just look at little things like that. How well have they been running? Don't just look at form figures, look at the numbers.
Okay, you say obviously if you're looking at something and there's an obvious favourite, but would you, when you're looking at a race, would you be looking at it with a completely open mind, or at least trying to?
Absolutely. But my MO is to try and find decent price winners. I always say to people that if I've tipped up some shorties, which I did a little while ago, 3 shorties, all lost, it actually embarrasses the hell out of me, to be honest, when that happens. So I try and find an angle that someone might not have thought about, to get a decent price. I mean, it boils the pants off me betting at even money, that sort of thing anyway. So so that is my MO. So I've got a total open mind about what's going to win the race, but as soon as I've found out what the favourite is and what I think the price might be, I'll then go looking to see, well, hang on, how can I get this beat?
Okay, there's plenty of ways these days to store like horses you've spotted and running, that sort of thing. Do you keep a notebook, or do you think they sort of skew your judgment a bit?
Yeah, I'm the latter. I'm absolutely against notebooks. I hate being asked to provide horses to follow, because I have to spend ages digging through stats and looking through our website trying to find some, because I think if you write things down, if you make notes, you use a tracker, you're going to back that horse next time it runs. The amount of people said to me, well, I had to back that, I put it in my tracker. I can't have that. Can't do that. You've got to look at the whole race again. Now, I'm not saying there haven't been times when I've seen a horse and it's been stuck in my head and I know I'm going to back it. Of course you do, but you've got to take the time to look at every single horse. Otherwise, you're going to miss something that will really annoy you, just because you've slavishly devoted yourself to one that you put in your track.
And would you quite often revisit the races via the videos after seeing something in the form book and thinking, I'll go and check that out myself?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I look all the time. When I'm studying form, I watch the videos, I'll read the analysis that we've got, see whether I agree with the analysis. I think if you've got the time, you've got to do that. I don't know, when I joined the Racing Post, the guys who did the spotlights and the tipping, they used to walk around with a great big rucksack over their shoulders with about 40 form books in it. I don't know how they did it, nobody barely saw a race, but now you can see it all. It's all there at your fingertips. If you've got the time, that's the only thing.
So what are your favourite types of races to study for picking winners?
I see, it's funny, it's a bit perverse really. On the flat, I love nothing more than a sprint. I do like sprint handicaps. Over jumps, I'm a 3 mile chase man. 3 mile handicap chase is a little bit weird, but no, I mean I like all sorts of races. I like the top end races. They just interest me more. But I would say I specialise and I prefer handicaps to the group races, probably because you can get more favourites beat.
Is it physically possible these days to keep on top of all the form so that you can study deeply enough to be successful?
I think if you want to be a professional, you've got to specialise. There are thousands and thousands of horses. You can't go through looking at every different type of race every single day. Not unless you're an absolute genius, and I'm certainly not one of those. So if you want to actually make it pay, pick a division or whatever. I mean, the BHA handicappers, they have handicappers solely for one division. You know, 2 milers, middle distance, sprinters, etc. So if that's what they do, then and you want to be a punter, why don't you do it? I can't do that. I have to look at all different types of races, which is why I like to prefer looking at the top end. I'm lucky enough to do the tipping in the racing post on Thursday, Friday and Saturday, so I don't have to deal with the rubbish. But I know a lot of people who do absolutely specialise on the lower class races and say that's where the money is to be made. So, it's each to their own, but I do think you've got to cut it down.
Okay, so you're in charge of the tipping at the racing post, so do you get to pick the races? Obviously that the calendar Thursday, Friday and Saturday sort of tell you anyway, but do you get to pick yourself what you want to study?
When I'm doing a column, that's fine. I can choose whatever races I want to tip. I'm not going to tell you that I will sit there on a Thursday and look at 5 Friday meetings and look at every single race to come and find a winner. I will shortlist 5 or 6 races and I'll go into them. And if at the end of that I haven't found a couple of bets, I'm in trouble because I'm running out of time anyway. But you can't look at everything; it's just not possible.
Okay, so if somebody said, was giving you races to study, what would be your absolute nightmare type of race?
Low class stuff. Sellers, selling hurdles, that sort of thing. It's stuff that, I'm not that interested in. To me it's got to be a lot harder than, a load of horses with duck eggs next to their names, all running against each other and haven't shown any form for ages. Some people specialise in that sort of thing, but, I like the higher end stuff, simple as that.
Okay, Paul, thanks very much. The previous part you talked about what you like to study, etc. Do you use private ratings apart from the racing post ratings, and if so, which ones?
I had a brief spell where I used a rating service which I cannot for the life of me remember the name of. Everyone was telling me how great it was. I didn't get on with it, and I don't know why I didn't get on with it. I mean, I think it was me. Since the Racing Post website started, that's all I've ever used, and that's what I was happy with. So that's what I'm happy with, and that's what I stick with now. I mean, I certainly wouldn't poo-poo the efforts of other ratings people, because I know lots of people are very shrewd, and they use them. So it's each to your own. But it's almost like growing up with one thing, and that's it. And for better or worse, I'm happy with it.
Okay, I remember the days of Superform getting the sheet once a week come through to put it into your file. Is it still like that with you, or do you use professional tools, modern tools these days?
It's all website, isn't it? There's the whole lot. I don't have anything written down. I don't make any notes on the web. I just click on, look at the numbers, and click on to the next horse, one after the other. So no, it's all there for me. I don't have to, I don't have to carry bags around with loads of notes or anything like that.
Okay, so other things that people look at. How much value do you place on speed ratings?
Speed ratings. Now, I know that I should make more effort, because I know a lot of people are very shrewd when it comes to speed ratings, but it's just something I've never really got to grips with. And, sometimes I think I try, but when, I like racing as a sport. I don't really want it to be spoken about as a science, even though it can be. You know what I mean? And I have a try myself. I remember talking to Simon Rowland from Timeform about some timings that I'd done, thinking I was really clever, and he went to me at the end and said, "Well, actually, that doesn't mean anything," he said. You know what I mean? And I do sometimes get a stopwatch out. You get an online stopwatch out, and I time a few things. But I'll be honest, I don't think I'm doing it properly. I don't think I know exactly what I'm doing. I did discover that Don Poley was a slow horse when I timed the when I timed the RSA chase a few years ago, though, because from three out to the line, he was miles slower than Cause of Causes, who ran in the 4 miler at the same day, and much slower after the last. Yeah, everyone thought Don Poley was a Gold Cup horse, and he couldn't possibly be.
So what about sectional time? Did you mention Simon Rowland's there?
Yeah, again, it's something I should pay more attention to. I do read bits and pieces that come up on Twitter, and I do find them interesting, and I do go back and have a look at the race and all that, but I'm just not a clock man, really.
Okay, what about breeding and stallion statistics?
I quite like, I put a chart in the paper years ago, stallions with their strike rates on there. On different grounds and all that. And all that can be found on the Racing Post website. If you look at a horse profile, click on the stallion. I look on that all the time, yeah. What are the strike rates on certain grounds? People will tell you, for instance, that Pivotal is a soft ground sire, but his strike rate is pretty much exactly the same from one extreme to the other. And what most people don't remember is I think he only ran on soft ground once in his life and hated it, and he was a proper fast ground horse. But so you do get some people that will pigeonhole a certain stallion as being one or other, but the stats are out there, you can have a look.
Okay, talking of stats, other people sort of come up with things that go back sort of decades. Do you know, no sort of three-year-old has won this and heavy going and that sort of thing, do you take notes?
I think some can be interesting. Obviously, I think most SP stats are nonsense, because so what? Especially when it comes to handicaps. The favourite hasn't won this for 20 years. Well, the favourite's 7-1 anyway. It's not, it doesn't take a genius to work out that 20, a run of 20 losers ain't a big deal, but there are other ones, older horses in races like the Gold Cup, Champion Hurdle, etc. Really, really good horses just haven't been able to win those sort of races. And I think, there are certain characteristics that are required to win certain races, and you can see that through history for sure. And I do like looking back and seeing if I can find something a little bit different. I like using Raceform Interactive, doing a few studies and whether it's just jockeys and trainers or a bit of breeding or history, how far horses have been beaten in certain races. I can find some things that are interesting there. So yeah, I do look.
So you mentioned that. That's quite a good tool, that Raceform Interactive. Do you sometimes have ideas and just punch them in and see what comes up?
Yeah, it's funny. I did one a few years ago where there was a race at it's a sprint handicap at York, and the first two, it was a class two, really valuable. The first two were, it was five lengths back to the third, and I thought that can't happen very often in a big field class two. And I looked at it, and I found a handful, and the horses that had been in the first two were all about £20 better than they were in a few weeks later, The one horse was the horse that was second was Dancing Star in this York race. So I tipped it up at Newmarket, and of course it ended up winning at Newmarket, and then won the Stewards Cup next time out. Did exactly what history said it would do. You know what I mean? So it is worth looking at things like that. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you like the big handicaps, etc. How do you take trainer, and I put this in inverted commas, shrewdness into account?
That's a hard one. I mean, you think, there's such and such a horse, such and such a trainer who's really good at laying them out for handicaps, But none of their strike rates are that good. Sometimes they have a horse. You have to have the horse in the first place, and then you can see how they are campaigned. I mean, sometimes it can be fairly obvious when there's a decent horse coming up through the ranks. They pick their races, the time between the races, etc., and they're going forwards. The top trainers, they place them really, really well.
Would there be a type of horse that you call a cliff horse that you would avoid, anything that sort of puts you away time and time again?
I've got loads of cliff horses, and again, it's one of those, if I had a tracker, it'd be full of those bleeding things. I have cliff horses. So I have horses that I just like, sometimes that I would back. And you really should avoid them. The horses that you want to avoid more than anything else are the horses that are unlucky. Because everybody's seen that they were unlucky last time, and everybody's going to want to back them, and they'll always be too short. And while you'll back some winners, unlucky horses are the ones that are just going to make you unlucky in the long run.
I remember going back in the day, you'd go through and tick off each race, a little mark, every time there was a winner thrown up from it. Obviously the most obvious way of seeing if a form line's any good, but are there less obvious ways that you look in that you can sort of say that's a good race?
I speak figure guys will tell you sectionals and times and whatever, but it's funny, I looked at, there were three horses, and I fell for the last one recently in the Mill Reef, chairman of the board, but the three horses that have run really good speed figures are 2-year-olds this season. First time out, won easily, all went off short prices in group or list races next time, all three got absolutely chinned. I do think, you know, collateral form, just, you know, seeing how many horses have come out and run really well is probably the best way to do it.
Okay, then finally on the form, what difference in your calculations would you put in a flat race between a top jockey and a top apprentice when you're trying to work out sort of pounds or whatever?
That's finding the right apprentice, isn't it? Because, you know, £3 or £4, £5 can make a hell of a difference when you've got a proper, you know, a proper decent apprentice. And there's some really good ones come out every year. I mean, this kid Jason Watson really, really is good. You know what I mean? And for a while he was claiming that was gold dust, and I don't think he's gonna have any problems whatsoever making the top rank. And then you get others that come along and you think, well, yeah, he's worth his £3. And then, you know, we might go overboard about them. And then the next year you realise, well, hang on a minute, he's found his level. And once they found that level, you can look back and say, well, actually, that £3 probably wasn't worth all that much. You know, you've got to get the right, apprentice. You've got to latch on to the really, really good ones that are going to come through. But there aren't that many that do come through every year. Otherwise, we'd be having great jockeys every single year. It doesn't happen like that. A lot of the top ones stay around for ages. So I would say, unless you really, really think this is a top, top-notch jockey, they're claiming that for a reason. And I wouldn't take too much into account.
Well, how much would you put into account for professional jockeys between themselves then?
For me, it's always horse first. You know, I mean, yeah. I have had a look at certain jockeys and certain tracks. There are certain jockeys with terrible strike rates at certain tracks, and I'm sure there's a mindset thing when they're going somewhere where they have rubbish records at. But then I have opposed horses for that reason and seen them win at the same time. So I try and boil it down to the horse. As long as it's not a jockey that I think, oh my God, I can't stand them, and I really haven't got many of them. I would say it's horse first and take the jockey as it is.
Okay, you say you take it very seriously, and obviously it's a job you have to. How much would you beat yourself up, not financially, afterwards, if you've made a decision, you've put someone up and then it's panned out differently? How much would you go away and stew about it for a while? But I should have sort of worked it out that way.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, it really annoys the hell at me. There was a horse that won at Cheltenham recently called Relentless Dreamer, and he was the first one on my list. And I ended up tipping a horse at half the price, which came nowhere. And of course, Relentless Dreamer won at 14, 16 to 1. That really annoyed me. So, I mean, missing a winner is worse than backing a loser, I think, you know, much worse. Making that wrong decision at the last minute, it can really annoy you. And of course, you know, I do feel deep sense of embarrassment when I'm on a losing run. And I think, you know, I think anybody who tips does. They think, when's the next winner coming from? And when you make the wrong decision, it hurts, it has to.
So how do you deal with it psychologically when you're having a bad run?
Good question. I don't know is the answer. Drink. The one thing you got to do is stay level-headed and try and keep on doing the same. If it goes on for too long, then whatever you're doing before doesn't work anymore, and then you've got to try and change it. But I think that you've got to stick to your guns to start with, and say, well, look, this is my MO. This has worked for so long. I'm going to keep on going. But there has to be a time limit on anything. You know, I'm sure there have been loads of tipsters in the past who suddenly lost it a little bit and thought to themselves, I've got to do something else now. And I think you've got to be fluid, you've got to be versatile and make the decision to change if it's not going right.
A few of the professional punters we've been lucky enough to speak to have all sort of said you need to keep adapting, you need to keep stepping ahead. Slightly with form study, would it be that same problem that it evolves, or...?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say how much form study can evolve, other than getting involved with timings, etc. If we had sectional times in every race course in Britain, I'm sure loads of people would end up getting involved in them, because they're there and freely available. They're not freely available for us. You've got people who work really, really hard to do them themselves. Am I prepared to do that? I'll be honest, no. So it's got to... You know, if it's there and available for you, but otherwise you've just got to do what's there and what you've got. And you know, I look at everything. I look at videos, ground form, etc. I don't see what how much more you can do to make it much more complicated.
And that's brilliant to my final question on the form study. Is there a point where you say, right, I've done enough now on this race, I'm confusing the hell out of myself, that's it, that's the selection?
Absolutely. I'll be honest to tell you, the harder I have to look, the less likely I am to find a winner. I mean, sometimes they come to me straight away, just like that. Like, you know, I can look at a race card, and even though I will look at every single horse, I can know what I'm going to tip. And I actually like it when it's like that, because you've got a certain amount of confidence in you as well, haven't you? You know, I don't just see this horse, that's going to win that race. And then you go about confirming that view by looking at the horses. You know, I will try to tell myself, right, you know you fancy this, now try and find a reason why it can't win. Not very easy to do once you've got that feeling in your head. But you know, I'm a field punter as much as a form studier as well. Like, you know, and I like that sort of gut feeling when I've got one. And yeah, you can go round and round in circles. Like, you know what I mean? So there is a point where you just have to say, nope, that's it, I've had enough.
Okay, but what a lot of people might not realise is when your spotlight writers finished analysing the race, they have to price it up, and the probable SP is their work. So where on earth do you start when pricing up a race?
First thing, again, as I said, when it comes to tipping horses, you've got to find out what the favourite is, and then you frame the race around it. You've obviously got to build in the bookmaker's profit margin, but you know, if you can find a favourite and a second favourite, then the rest you'll find yourself. It is not easy. And a lot of people, you know, you do get the occasional criticism of a racing post spotlight. You have to remember that these guys are doing 60 horses a day, and they're doing 60 words for 60 horses and another sentence for the app. And you know, so they're knocking out the best part of 4,000 words a day and doing SP forecasts. I actually think they do a remarkable job with their SP forecasts and the spotlights themselves. But you know, the one golden rule is you have to find the favourite first.
So would you price up originally to 100% and then try and work around?
Well, I was always told that. But I mean, if you price up a book to 100%, 90% of the time you're not going to find a bet. Because especially when you're talking 16 minor handicaps, they can be betting to 130. I think you have to be realistic. I'm somebody who's looking to have a bet, not looking to find the one point that's wrong in the 500 races that you're doing, like, you know what I mean? So yeah, I mean, if you want to do it to 100%, do it to 100%, but most of the time you'll end up not having a bet.
Sorry to keep labouring the point here. So you find the favourite, and then you sort of look for two or three that have got realistic chances of beating it and split it up between them, and then...
Yeah, exactly. You build it around it, and then the other ones become obvious. Well, this is a quite an outsider now, isn't it? Like, you know what I mean? Here's the favourite. Here's one, two, three, four dangers. And the rest, and then you know, you build it in. You know what I mean? If you've got a rag that's trained by John Gosden, it's a shorter price than a rag that is trained by Joe Blocks. You know what I mean? So you've got, you know, there are ways to work it out, but you know, you have to start with a favourite. Get your pecking order, and then you can look at how strong the rest is, and then you have an idea of how big they're going to be, and then you have to build the margins backwards.
Okay, would you agree with the common sort of philosophy now that Betfair sorts out the true price by the off?
By the off, yes. Yeah. I mean, look, the vast majority of Betfair action is in the last 5 or 10 minutes these days anyway, isn't it? You know what I mean? The markets are not particularly liquid in the morning, overnight, or even an hour before the race, but come the final few minutes, you'll see some big moves. A lot of big punters, of course, can't get on with traditional bookies, so they're waiting. There's no point in throwing their hand away early when there's no money around. So that's when you get big moves. I mean, people might say that, you know, it's not straight. Look at the money for this. Look at this big drifter coming. It is just literally waste weight of money from really good punters who know what they're doing.
Okay, so if you price the race up and then the exchanges differ wildly from what you sort of thought of the race, would you put that down to their better judgment, or would you
still in a rat of it? No, I think you've got to. I think you have to be confident in your own ability, because you would half be sick if you're right and you've decided not to have a bet. That's the important thing. Like, you know, I always say to people, I'm quite happy when everybody else disagrees with me, because I've got a far better chance of making money then. If everyone agrees with me, you're not going to get the right price. So, you know, never, ever, ever be afraid of a price just because the market doesn't fancy it and you do. It's a really, really stupid thing to do, because you can miss big price, you can miss decent price winners. just because you're scared that you're wrong. I mean, that's daft.
Okay, so you wrote a book on the exchanges, good one, about 10 years ago now, I think. How do you feel now? Are they a good or a bad thing?
I like the exchange. I like the exchange from punting. I mean, you know, I don't really use them for racing seriously. I like to. Most of my betting tends to be ante-post 5 days before the race. You know, on a Monday night when all the markets are priced up. That's when I like to do it. Obviously, I think you've got fantastic each. You know, if you can get on, you have fantastic each way terms every single Saturday nowadays with the main bookmakers. They really are. They're fighting for your money. If you know, again, it, you know, it's one of those. You can say it's never been a better time to be a mug punter, because you can get on and you can get great value and you'll lose your money much slower than you used to 20 years ago. But if you're any good, you're going to struggle. And then it's Betfair for you with win only and traditional place terms. I like the exchanges. I like punting on them. I like watching the markets. I don't think they're a bad thing. I mean, obviously, some bad things have happened with, you know, people laying horses, etc. But, you know, a lot of them have been caught, and nobody was ever caught beforehand.
That's interesting you say that, because one of the things you do notice, I used to go to Kempton a lot, big drifters on the all-weather, low-grade races, that they suddenly fall out of the stalls or they hit some terrible bad luck after they've drifted remarkably. Do you think the horse racing cracks down on that sort of thing enough, or is it just really punters remembering those days?
Look, you know, we have seen in the past that there have been, you know, a few shady characters and a few people laying horses to lose and things like that going on. I think it's probably straighter than most people think it is. But, you know, any sport in which there is money being traded and you can bet on it, and the money, the prize money itself is so low, then it is going to attract people. You know, it's going to track wrong ones, basically. Like, you know what I mean? But I think it's straighter than most people think. And I do think the vast majority of big drifts are simply market corrections. Good punters betting with their opinions. You know, and if something comes in, something else has got to go out.
So it's only, you think only the punters only remember when
that's... Of course they do. Like, I've backed loads of drifters and loads of them have lost, and I thought to myself, oh, what went on there? This is a bit wrong, but then I backed a few that have won, and I thought, oh, clever. You know what I mean? You get a bad taste in your mouth when something goes wrong. Right, you know, but I mean, you know, I think there was a study done a few years ago where if you backed all the horses that had come in by a certain percentage, you'd be far worse off than if you'd backed all the horses that had gone out by a certain percentage. Like, you know what I mean? Drifters do win.
Okay, given punters, you know, people that are aspiring to improve their punting, a lot of good advice here. Now, do you think that if they were, would you advise anyone to specialise on like all-weather racing?
If you want to, yeah. it's not something that I'm going to do. It's sort of grown on me over the years. When I first saw all-weather racing, I just saw it as betting shop fodder, low-class stuff, which would bore me if it was on grass, to be honest. A lot of it is a lot better than that now, particularly Chelmsford put on some really, really good racing. And there's, you know, there is good racing at all the tracks at times. There, I'll be happy with it. Some people do. I do know that some people are looking. Some people really, really specialise at Southall, and I wouldn't even turn my telly on for Southall. You know, but you know, if you can do it and it interests you, and you can, if you know anything that can give you an edge, then yeah, do it.
Just going back briefly to your sort of. When did you suddenly discover that you had a talent for picking winners?
It was strange, really, because I promise you, I spent a good 20 years being a complete mug punter. I mean, you know, I just liked having a bet, like, you know, and I didn't really mind losing. I'm not the most disciplined man in the world, never will be. I had a mate who used to be this deputy sports editor here years ago, and he went to Australia, and he kept asking me for tips for Cheltenham and Royal Ascot and stuff like that, and I'd send him a brief preview, and I was giving him loads of winners, and it surprised even me. And then when I took over, I got the title of betting editor, it was literally just a production job, looking after all the other tipsters and drawing up pages. So I wasn't doing any tipping at all. I started standing in for people. I then got asked to stand in for the Weekender a couple of times. Then Matt Williams, who did the Weekender, left. And then they asked me to do it full time. And I got hate mail. I started I started okay in the first jump season in 2010, but the flat season of 2011 was embarrassing. I mean, it was terrible. I barely had a winner. The losses were like, you know, 30%, I think, overall, 35%, I think it was. And then the 2011-12 jump season was the complete opposite. I mean, I was just going back to have a look at my figures, because I've never really kept a record at a weekend. Hard to do, because you get loads of non-runners when there's no markets and they don't count. But I looked at it, and the profit for the 2011-12 season was more than 100%. And I was staggered by that. I knew I'd had a really good year that year. I'll be interested to see whether I've made any profits over the next few years. I'm in profit in 2018, I can tell you that. But the rest, I don't know. It just suddenly fell into place. I really enjoy looking at racing.
I mean, it all boils down to me. Do you have an awful lot of sympathy for punters that can't really be bothered and just copy you?
I wouldn't say sympathy.
When they're having a go at you, I mean, you know.
Look, people have a go. All right? There are people who expect you to tip winners all the time, even though you're tipping 10, 12, 20 to 1 shots, etc. That's just silly. You get lots of people who have a dig, and, you know, I mean, like, sometimes I will amuse myself by winding them up on Twitter. Other times I'll just block them. You know, you've got some really, really decent people out there who just like the fact that here you are presenting them a case, you give them a good read. I like to give them a good read as well. Like, you know what I mean? Not just say back this. I hate the idea that I just give you one sentence, I fancy this, go away and back it. I just want to say, here's why. If you agree with it, please back it. If you don't, please come to your own conclusion, back something else. And if I'm wrong, I really do hope you win. I like to see punters win. I like to hope that I've helped some win at some of the time. And I like to think that when I'm on a losing run, they've jumped ship a lot earlier than I have myself. You know what I mean? So, you know, I mean, I like to see people win. I like to think that I can give them some sort of help. And, you know, at least say, look, this is the way I look at it. Try and do it yourself, see what you can come up with.
So one of the success stories of the Racing Post in the past has been PriceWise. Now, do you think PriceWise is still viable in the world as 24-hour betting?
It would be a crying shame to get rid of the brand, because it's, you know, it was brilliant since its inception in 1987, the first PriceWise column ever came out. And but the problem is, bookmakers no longer hold the prices. We already made the decision a year and a half ago to no longer tip at prices in the paper. Because those prices aren't there anymore. When people go down the shop and pick up, you know, there are two or three firms who will guarantee for, you know, 5 minutes. I think one of those only guarantees the PriceWise selection. And you can't really blame bookmakers for that either, because, you know, when the Racing Post still started, there wasn't any evening opening, there wasn't any internet. They just got up in the morning, and their prices that they'd set at 6 p.m. went live at 10 o'clock in the morning. Nowadays, it's, you know, those prices are traded all week. The decks are made on a Thursday. They're priced up by, you know, most races are priced up by Friday morning then as well for Saturday, and they're traded all day. How can you expect them to say, right, we're finishing this horse at 14-1 at 5:30 on a Friday, when we've got to set the paper and get it off to print, and, you know, it's going to go down to 8-1 by 8 p.m. but we're going to put it back out at 14-1 in the morning. It can't happen anymore. So I think price-wise, you know, maybe we should put the prices out first off when they go at 8 p.m. But then they're not live for very long. What do you do then? People are still going to be looking at it at midnight, at 6 o'clock the next morning, and we're saying back this at 12-1, and it'll show 7-1 on the bet link. So it's hard. I think it's worth still carrying tables to show people how the bookmakers were betting. But the best thing you can do now is get on at the best price you can, but you cannot expect prices that have been there overnight to still be there in the morning anymore.
Would there be a case for putting the minimum price for value?
There is a case for that, but the problem I find with that is, how do you record it? You say, get on at 10-1, so you say, right, well, it was 10-1 at one stage and then it wins. You think, do I write that down as 10-1 when I'm recording the figures? I don't see how you can. Did people get the 10-1? Did people, you know, it's now 8-1 now. Half the people that you've tipped it to are now not going to back it. So, you know, I think the only thing we can do is keep our own records at SP and tell people to get on at the best price they can. Now, SP makes it virtually impossible for anybody to make a decent profit. So it is not the fairest way to judge any tipsters. It's very difficult, because, you know, if you're tipping in a 20-runner race at SP, there's a 30%, maybe more, you know, Grand National 50% margin in favour of the bookmakers. How are you expected over time to keep beating that and make a profit? I made a tiny one in 2017, an even smaller one so far in 2018, on the brink of going into the red as we speak. So it is very difficult. If it was Betfair SP, we could do that. Don't know how fair that is either. It'd be interesting to know what people think. If it was Betfair SP, my P&L this year would be nearly 20%, which I think is adequate. But it's a lot different at SP. I just think the only way you could do it at SP, but we're never going to be able to be that bullish about big numbers anymore.
Okay, you mentioned the Racing Post going to print. Now, is it always going to be going to print, or is it going to go online solely, do you think?
I think there'll be a time in the future when all newspapers are digital only. I don't think there are any immediate or even long-term plans for the Racing Post to go that way. That sort of thing is way above my pay grade anyway. I certainly wouldn't have heard anything about it. But, you know, you look at the way you go. Every newspaper in the country, you know, around the world is losing readers to online. That's where people are going. The older people that, you know what I mean, the generations that read papers are dying off, and now everybody goes to digital. So at some point, I think all papers will go that way. I hope it is not in my lifetime, but you never know.
Okay, and finally, a golden rule for an aspiring form student like yourself.
Golden rule, discipline. Be more disciplined than I am. You'll do a hell of a lot better. that's about all I can say. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you haven't got discipline, if you can be a clown with money like I can, then you're going to struggle. But I mean, you know, just if you want to take it seriously, you've got to be disciplined.
Paul Keelan, thank you very much.
No worries.
For the latest political betting news and odds, check in with our expert William Kajani at starsportsbet.co.uk. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.